this year or this series of prominent speakers that we are having, thanks to the funding from the teams and my task. This time is we have invited, and we are very glad to have here Professor Martin from University of Washington and Matt Soft that has recently transformed into Insightful or changed name very recently. Professor Martin is a very well-known statistician. He is one of the founder members of the Department of Statistics at the University of Washington. He's also a founding member of the sole founding person of Stat Science, who developed S+ and now became MassSoft, and is still going through changes and growing very impressively. And so that contribution to statistics are twofold. One, he has very important academic contribution, very long record of publication, including invited papers in Annals of Statistics and JRSS, to mention a few. And he has also had a great influence in statistics through all the development of INS+, which is making a very modern method in statistics available to people. So today Doug is going to talk to us about the robust factor model fitting and visualization of stock market returns. Thank you very much, Doug.
Thanks, Ruben. It's a pleasure to be here and see old friends that I haven't seen in a long time and talk about many things. I'd like to thank PIMS for inviting me, and also maybe most of you don't know, PIMS arranged a very nice cooperative arrangement with MassSoft, by which MassSoft made a contribution to support a postdoc here, Matthias Salibian, who had worked at MassSoft for a while and is up here now, and I think this is a start of a good ongoing relationship. I'd like to also say that it's a special pleasure to have Ruben invite me. I was the lucky faculty member in every true sense of the word to have Ruben as a student to work with and keep pushing me to think harder when I couldn't understand things. And some of the pivotal work here is due to Ruben and colleagues, initially a little bit me and then Victor Yohai. We'll get to that. Now, also, I have to say that I'm not a recycled chairman yet, and I swear that I never will be, unlike some people I know here. but as I said, it's ecologically sound, so I recommend you get him for a third time when you get a chance. He's going to not give me my beer tonight for that one, I guess. But I'm kind of a recycled academic. I mean, I've been very involved in the commercial world for the last 7 or 8 years, and I look fondly back on those invited papers, which are increasingly in my distant past. But I have to tell you, I've gotten re-excited about the opportunities at the interface between statistics and finance, which I discovered quite accidentally when the head of sales 3 or 4 years ago forced me to go to New York and talk to some customers at Goldman Sachs and places like that. And all of a sudden I started talking to these guys who were doing this really cool stuff, and it wasn't solving partial differential equations to price exotic options. It was really about data and statistical modeling, and it wasn't just about math, really. And it wasn't just about finance. It was very interdisciplinary in nature. So I've gotten really slowly getting back into trying to do some things and find some interesting things to do with that interface, and that's what this talk is about today. The visualization part is a little bit misleading in the sense that I wrote the abstract before I put the slides together, and when I got up to 30 slides and I hadn't gotten to the visualization part, I realized I'd have to tell you that I will show you a tiny bit of visualization at the end that I hope will whet your appetite. So it'll be mostly about some simple factor model fitting. I say why this talk is because financial data often contains outliers, and robust statistics can be very useful. Before I make my next comment, are there any people in the room who work in finance? Is there anyone in the room who works in finance at all? So I mean I can bash the people in finance arbitrarily badly without anybody fighting back? Oh my God. Okay. Data visualization is also not much used in finance. I beg of you to go and pick up the Journal of Finance and try to find a graph. It's utterly amazing, tables after tables after tables that are begging to be at least have a two-way analysis done on them or something. So I'm going to, as I said, I'm going to show you a tiny bit of visualization at the end, and then a sort of honest from the heart, somewhat contaminated by marketing pitch for S Plus and the new robust methods library that we already released in Unix and are going to release in S Plus 6 for Windows this spring. I was going to say outliers can be noise or real. I'm not going to dwell on this example very long. There are many like it. This happens to be a little over 2 years of a natural gas futures contract in blue and the natural gas spot price in the sort of pinkish red. And the outliers in pink and red are real outliers. And that little thing going to zero, you all know what that is, right? That was a piece of missing data. Somehow they didn't have it. So that's a kind of noise, if you like, and I assure you both occur, and you need to find out which it is in the end. The examples I'm going to show you, the outliers, are real, but in finance, I would say outliers are rarely, if ever, predictable, and if you find a good way to predict outliers, please tell me, because I'd like to take advantage of the approximate arbitrage opportunity and buy my house in Taos. Anyway, by the way, when you actually, it turns out that if you know about or bother to read about how you choose hedge ratios using futures contracts, it turns out that what you do is you take the difference between the futures price over a time interval that's about the time of the contract until you're going to roll it over, and you do the same thing on the spot price, and you just compute the correlation between the two, and that leads you to an optimal hedge ratio in the mean squared error sense. So outliers, I just said that because outliers in this series will say that single outlier, if you just leave it be a zero, will produce two outliers when you do that differencing. Okay, so the first part of the talk, I want to introduce you to robustness a bit, and I'm going to assume that you know nothing about robustness, which some of you do, I know, so bear with me. First, data-oriented robustness. As everyone knows practically, the classical estimates like least squares, for example, in a linear model are highly influenced by outliers. And worse, may not reveal at all the presence of outliers. And I'm going to show you an example when I demo S Plus at the end where there are several outliers in the data that are, just wouldn't be revealed by the least squares analysis. So the issue is that if you just have two variables, you can always plot it and see what's going on. But when you have 10 predictor variables or 20 or, you know, estimating covariance matrices with 20 or any number of variables, it's very hard to detect outliers sometime because the classical estimate's distorted and then you just don't see it in the residuals, okay? So from a data-oriented point of view, a robust estimate provides a good fit to the bulk of the data. It downweights outliers to obtain the fit. And above all, it clearly exposes the outliers. And there's supposed to be a data mining theme here. So the data mining theme is, in a nutshell, if you had good robust methods and if you can make them scalable, which is a real challenge, they have the potential to discover outliers in databases and alert people to them and find out whether they're, you know, good outliers or bad outliers or what, whether it's credit card fraud or it's just noise in the data and so on. So here's an example that I just got last week from a customer at DuPont in the corporate finance group. It's a trivial example, but this is some firm whose short name is Invensys. I didn't even look it up, but this guy had actually used our robust regression procedure to get the solid line fit to this earnings per share over time on an annual basis. And his job in corporate finance, I mean, this is a trivial example, but he collects earnings per share data, and you know, CEO asks him, so, well, predict our earnings per share next year, right? So, it seems trivial, and you wouldn't think people do this, but they do, right? So, obviously, least squares doesn't fit much of the data well. There were two outliers near the end of the series, but then you came back to two data points that fit the line reasonably well, and the robust fit fits the bulk of the data well. Okay, that's the data-oriented. Here's another example where you would estimate a covariance matrix, and I didn't get around to putting the ellipses in for the classical and robust one, but I just show you another example of exchange rates. This is 100 observations of, this was weekly data on Japanese yen returns versus Australian dollar returns. I'm going to be using returns later on. So returns is the relative change in the value from one time period to the next. Okay, so it's today's exchange rate minus yesterday's divided by yesterday's. So you see numbers here that range from minus 0.04 to 0.02. So there's a couple of points there that most people would declare outliers in the lower left. And I just point out that if you use a classical correlation coefficient, you get 0.54. If you delete the three smallest in the yen coordinate, then you get 0.33. And so the effect of these two outliers, or three, have been to sort of elongate the ellipse conceptually and inflate the correlation. The robust estimate that was used here was 1 in S plus gives you 0.28. So just everywhere you look, you see this sort of thing, I guess, is the main point. So that's kind of the data-oriented flavor of the game here. Now, I'm going to say a few things about probabilistic or statistically based robustness. And I think this statement, robust means continuous, deserves some emphasis in teaching statistics. It's pretty much lost, but what it really means is if the distribution of the data changes a little bit, so imagine you're just estimating the sample mean, the center of the data, you're estimating the mean with the sample mean. You've got a nominal normal distribution. When I say the distribution changes a little bit, I mean typically the tails get a little thicker, and so they generate outliers. The distribution generates outliers. Now the question is, what happens to the distribution of the statistic that gets induced by the mapping from the underlying distribution for the data to the distribution for the statistic? Well, for the sample mean, that mapping is not continuous in appropriate metrics. But a robust statistic would have the property that if you change the underlying distribution from normal to heavy-tailed normal a little bit different, then the distribution of the estimator would change only a little bit. So I think this deserves to be called a principle of statistics on the same level as the likelihood or sufficiency or anything else. The reason it's never made it, I believe, is because this, although the correct fundamental principle, is horribly complex technically. It really has to do with equicontinuity of a sequence of maps using Proov metrics, and okay, maybe a few of us who want to do theory are going to understand that, but try teaching it to an undergraduate, forget it. I guess I can't say that for an undergraduate what I'm going to do next is going to be quite right either, but at least for a broader range of graduate students, I think it will be. So instead of looking at continuity in a very sort of general way, what Rubin and I actually started in the late 80s was to look at bias robustness. And before I comment on that transparency, let me just draw a little picture in the context of fitting a straight line, which is about all I'm going to be doing today, except by example in S plus later, is that suppose we just have a scatter of yx on x data that looks something like that. If it turns out that outliers get generated more or less, you know, sort of all over the place like this, in other words, sort of the distribution of the outliers is independent of x, then what that's going to do is induce excess variability in the straight line fit by least squares. Is that sort of intuitively clear? It's like the error distribution, the model's correct, the error distribution generates outliers symmetrically or maybe even asymmetrically. Let's just say symmetrically to keep things simple now. That's induced variability, but no induced bias. On the other hand, if it turns out that things like this happen, you tend to, whenever you get outliers, they sort of all tend to be in a preferred region up there. That is, the conditional distribution of the outliers definitely depends on x. Then you have a bias-inducing contamination distribution, if you like. And so then, on average, you're going to be like this. Okay. So what we started focusing on was the maximum bias in a statistic that could be induced by some fixed fraction of contamination, with the contamination distribution being arbitrary. Well, why is that? First, why is that a good concept? I just remarked that if you focus on mean squared error is the sum of variance and bias squared. Typically, variance goes to zero, like 1 over n, for most reasonable estimates. So as the sample size gets at all large, squared bias dominates mean squared error. And it turns out that that happens surprisingly quickly, as Rubin and I showed in our first paper in 1989. So the idea here is that you have some nominal distribution that you draw from, fraction 1 minus gamma at the time, some other very arbitrary distribution, not necessarily symmetric, that you draw from a fraction gamma at a time. And this B of gamma Tn there is the maximum bias that you can get as you let H range. So hold F0 fixed, hold gamma fixed, but let H be as perverse as nature can make it. Compute the maximum bias. Now, so the question is, what's the maximum bias of the sample mean under a model like that? Well, the picture is something like the following. The picture is something like, here's the unknown mean. Here's the normal distribution that's drawn from 1 minus gamma at the time. And then the other gamma at the time, you know, nature can play anything. So, like, nature can put a point mass out here with probability gamma at x, but x can get larger and can be large as you like. So is it not clear to everyone that the maximum bias of the sample mean is infinity, plus or minus infinity? It's like saying you have a sample of data, compute the sample mean, take one data point, drag it to plus infinity, the sample mean goes to plus infinity. Okay? And in regression, you can do the same thing. You can put outliers up there, always put them up there. When they draw from the contamination distribution, the slope can go to infinity, okay? In the case of location, you could use the sample median, and the sample median would be robust, and it would have a bounded bias. So the idea is, in bias robustness, is to choose the estimator to make the maximum bias small for every fraction of contamination. And this leads to focusing on maximum bias curves. And excuse me, these were meant to be handed out. There's a blank transparency here, so if you want to draw this in as I'm drawing it, I just didn't get my artwork going. But it's sort of something like this. So here's the fraction of contamination. Here's 0.5, which is sort of the maximum fraction of contamination that's meaningful. If you go more than that, then which is the central part of the data. And here's the maximum bias as a function of gamma for various estimators. And all classical estimators, least squares, classical correlations, if you transform them appropriately and so on, sort of live right here. That is, as soon as there's any non-zero fraction of contamination, their bias is arbitrarily bad. And but robust alternatives could give you curves, maximal bias curves that, let me just draw a couple here. Suppose I had two that looked like this, and suppose this singularity here is at 0.5, and this singularity here is at 0.4, let's say, and this is estimator T2, and this is estimator T1. If you're allowed to choose between those two estimators just based on maximum bias, obviously you choose T2 because it has uniformly smaller maximum bias than T1. So that's the theoretical game that Rubin and I started, and then there's a lot of other work that followed that. I should remark that Peter Huber, in his original classic paper in 1964, in a very unnoticed part of the paper, proved that for estimating location, the sample median is the min-max bias robust estimator. And I think that's a result that deserves to be better known. And one reason it's not better known is Huber made little of it. It wasn't the interesting theory for him at that point in time. And actually, when Ruben and I started, we thought, gee, why hasn't anybody worked on this? It's been like 20 years. This seems like a meaningful problem. And when you look at Huber's book on robustness, you find the same comments. He repeats the proof of the median being min-max bias robust and says, but it leads to an uneventful theory. It's an exact quote. So Ruben and I were sort of challenged. We were sort of challenged and almost didn't start, but I remember it was our good friend and colleague Victor Yohai in Buenos Aires once, and I told Victor about this problem. He said, that sounds very hard. And when he said it sounded very hard, I said, okay, forget it, I'm not going to try it. But then almost like 30 seconds later, he said, but no, you should start. You know, so Ruben and I started, and we actually got something. And you'll see where it led in the factor model fitting context shortly. But I wanted to say one more thing. Bias robustness alone is not enough. And the leading example to prove this statement is that least median of squares, which was introduced by Peter Rousseau, is conceptually very natural regression estimate, right? Instead of taking, you know, the average of the square deviations and minimizing it, which is least squares, he said, well, the median is a robust estimate for location, so let's take the median of the squared residuals and minimize that. And Peter is not here, and he was here, and if he were here, I would still say this. He jumped the gun far too fast in marketing this estimator, because it has zero efficiency. That is, at the Gaussian model, its variance is infinitely greater than that of least squares. And the reason is that this estimator converges at a slower rate than usual. Okay? And in case you wonder why, it's because the objective function for least median squares is very rough. And that's a fact that goes unnoticed, but that you could check yourself by a simple experiment. But I just want to draw you a picture. If you took 100 normal zero ones, and if you took the median of the observations, these are normal zero ones, 100, if you took the median of that minus this parameter, squared it, and plotted it versus mu, you would get an incredibly jagged-looking function like that. And when you're trying to minimize a function like that, it's sort of intuitively clear why it should converge slowly, right? Because, you know, as you're optimizing, the thing jumps back and forth, you know, these sort of steps that are too large. Okay. So what you need is to add something to the soup here, to the broth, and what you add is you say, well, if my nominal model holds, say if Gaussian is your nominal model, you say, I want this robust estimator to have high efficiency at the nominal model. Not 100%, but 90% will be just fine, thank you. 90% is only a little over 5% penalty in standard deviation. That is 90% in variance. So what happened? I'll get to that. Sorry, I'm slightly out of order here. But so let me kind of turn now to the focal point of applying robust regression and talk about a particular robust regression estimate that has the property that it controls bias very nicely and achieves high efficiency when the data is Gaussian. Okay, so what are factor models in finance? Well, factor models are linear regression models. And since there's no one in finance here, I guess what I should just say a few things here about factor models and what they look like and what people in finance really do with them. The left-hand side are returns. These independent variables in finance, if you pick up a finance paper in this, are usually called exposures or factor exposures. And they can be things like, you know, size of a firm, the market capitalization, some volatility measure of the stock, price earnings, book, things like that that are numeric. And then there are usually other sort of fact categorical variables, or we would call them, like sector or industry or country. And I'm going to show you an example of Barra. Barra is a $200 million company in California that sells portfolio management software. And one of their big claims to fame is they build large factor models. And they sell the large factor models. And when I first saw this, I said, gee, that's something any graduate student in statistics can do. And it's almost true. It's almost true. But it's a little tricky And it's quite dirty in getting the data together and cleaning. But let me just try to give you, well, down here I'm going to say what we're going to look at, among other things today, is a single factor market model in which what appears on the right-hand side is an intercept, and the X will be a return for the market, like the S&P 500, you know, or the NASDAQ, or the Russell 2000. So that's a very simple straight line fit model, but we will see it. That's one possible case here. And then it's a time series model. For each firm, you're going to do the regression across time. What, maybe I should go down here and say, the reason people fit factor models are two reasons. The academics in finance fit them as models of explaining returns, of predicting returns. But for portfolio managers, these factor models are built primarily to construct a covariance matrix using a moderately low-dimensional model. Okay, so what you've got, say you have 1,000 equities or stocks you're looking at, or 6,000, the portfolio risk to calculate it requires that you have the covariance matrix. And it gets out of hand when you get into, you know, many thousands of firms. So what they do is they fit factor models with anywhere from 10 to 60 coefficients, and that's a more parsimonious representation. And then you take the covariance matrix for this that's induced by the fitted model. That's what they do, okay? Here's one example I wanted to mention briefly. Due to Barra, for example, their European equity model has six or seven numeric factors, which they call risk indices. I've already mentioned, like, size, book to market, and so on. 19 industry categories and 16 countries. And when they fit their model, they found that the UK was really different than everyone else. Actually, in this paper that I referenced, that you can look at that website, they made the comment, this is a 1999 paper, they were really interested in seeing whether the ins versus the outs relative to adapting the euro made any difference, right? That was one of their goals. And they found out it didn't, that the difference between UK and all the rest outweighed everything else. So they ended up with, you know, they separated UK out, so they ended up, if you add that up, 60 parameters, so 60 parameter model. And that's what these commercial firms do. However, they seem to be totally unaware, almost, except for Barr is the one, of outliers, and the outliers might be upsetting the estimates. We've done a recent survey of Value Line and Bloomberg and Standard & Poor's and everyone in sight, and you call them up and you have an RA get on the phone and spend hours trying to get somebody to answer your call, and finally say, what outliers, what are they? Honest to God, I have a paper submitted to Financial Analyst Journal, and we're revising it, and the reviewer said, oh, well, people have known how to Windsorize data since 1970, right? So we had done this exercise before. This time we did it more thoroughly. We kept all the names, all the phone numbers, and when we send the paper in, we're going to say we've contacted 12 well-known suppliers, and none of them except Barra do anything, okay? That's the truth. Okay, so regression M estimates. So the idea here is to replace the quadratic loss function for least squares with something that somehow makes outliers less influential. And if you differentiate that to get the estimating equation, you get something like this, where this psi is the derivative of the rho. Peter Huber introduced these estimates way back in the early 70s in regression. And Peter Huber's favorite, let me sketch some rho functions for you here just to set the stage. Okay, rho functions. Okay, residuals here. Okay, so there's quadratic is least squares, okay? There's least squares. People in economics tend to be pretty familiar with the L1 or least absolute deviation estimate, right? So everyone's familiar with that. And then what Peter Huber did was Peter Huber said, well, I'm going to make a nice compromise. I'm going to go minus C plus C, and then quadratic inside there, and then linear. So that's Huber's loss function, which is sort of a nice blend between least squares and L1. So a lot of people have used that historically, and the question is, are M estimates robust, is the general question. Assuming for now, for this discussion, random, that the X's are random. The X's are not fixed as in design experiments. The question has a different answer then. But in finance, There are some fixed Xs like sectors and countries, but these other variables sometimes contain outliers. So the answer to this question is no, M estimates are not robust. I mean by this, they're not bias robust if rho is unbounded. So Huber's estimator, which is supposed to help, is unbounded and is not bias robust. And everyone needs to know that and spread the gospel. You need bounded rho for robustness. Okay. It's also needed for efficiency robustness against very heavy tailed distributions, but that's secondary. So now I come to the solution that Rubin and Victor discovered. And did I get the date right, 98? Was it published 98? So basically, they solved the problem to minimize the maximum bias locally for small fractions of contamination subject to the efficiency being constrained at the Gaussian model. And what I was just amazed by the solution. It's really remarkable in sort of an intuitive sense. So here's a theoretical approach that led to this class of bounded rho functions, quadratic in here and then becomes flat. And of course, the blue is for 95% efficiency, and as you want to control outliers more, this comes down and you become less efficient at the Gaussian model. And over here, the derivative, the psi function, it's linear in the middle, and then it goes to zero at some symmetrically located points. And what's really nice about this is that, well, for years, engineers and other people have had the notion of hard rejection, that is, of things like three sigma edit rules, where you compute the mean, compute the standard deviation. Any data point that's larger than three times the standard deviation with the mean, you throw it away. That is a rule like this that is linear and then is discontinuous and jumps to zero. And, well, the problem with that is it not only does it cause problems in the optimization, but it results in an estimator that's not continuous to small perturbations of the data, right? You're a little rounding and you move the data point from one side to the other, rejection, you get a different answer. That's not good. So this estimator makes a nice smooth transition back to zero and does it in a way that solves an optimality problem. And furthermore, where it makes that transition in the flanks of the distribution where it's hardest to tell whether the data point's an outlier or not. So it's kind of natural. I think it's a beautiful solution, and this is what we use in S plus today as the default choice. Now I have two stories. So that's the, any questions about robustness? It's kind of just a quick whirlwind tour, kind of data-oriented robustness, and what, there are many concepts of robustness, but I think if you want to hang your hat on one that's got a theoretical base and reasonably simple bias robustness is it, subject to a constraint on efficiency. Okay. Okay, so I have two stories here now applying robust regression to financial data. The first story is has to do with the problem, I'm going to put a transparency up here, of modeling equity returns in terms of various fundamental data, but the only one I'm going to look at now is firm size. And if I can find my transparency, I'll put it up at the same time I'm talking here. I'm getting there. So I'll come back to the lines in a minute, but this is a cross section of 500, I think it's like 529 firms in 1963, when in 1963 NASDAQ didn't exist, so there was just, the New York Stock Exchange and the American Stock Exchange. And so these are the returns, which I defined before, it's the relative change in the stock price from one month to the next in this case. Firm size is the log of market capitalization in millions. That's the conventional way people do it in finance. If you don't take the log transformation, it doesn't look very good in this case. Again, market capitalization is the price of the stock times the number of outstanding shares. You measure that in millions, take its log, that's firm size. So what this picture is saying that large size firms are less volatile in their returns than small size firms. And Fama and French wrote a famous paper in 1992. It's quite famous in finance. And part of the paper said stock returns are negatively related to firm size. And, well, okay, Here's 1 month of, they took data from 1963 to 1989 or 90, I believe it was, in their study. It'll show up in another transparency. Dashed line is least squares, which obviously is tipped up by some outliers for small size firms. And the robust line is not so much influenced by those outliers. So basically what Pham and French did is they fit by OLS every month, did that over time, took the sample mean of all those slopes, built a t-statistic, and the t-statistic was significantly negative. So their statement was equity returns are negatively related to firm size. Well, so what happened is that Peter Kanez, whom I happened to run into about 95, was a MATLAB user. This is a success story for S+. He was a MATLAB user, and he heard about this thing, S+, and he discovered it had a robust regression method. So he got the product, and he started playing around with it, and he realized that, gee, these outliers were sort of biasing, you know, the Fama-French results in the negative direction. So he used robust regression, repeated the same experiment, and concluded that returns are positively related to firm size, except for a small fraction of small size firms. I mean, I'm going to show you another picture here. Let me show you now. Not all months look like that. By the way, you think this is really a robustness problem? Yeah.
So I'm not entirely convinced that there is not a problem with the data. I mean, your data cannot be heterocyclic. How do you know this?
That's the question I was hoping somebody would ask. You know, when I show this slide alone, almost there is heteroscedasticity. Conditionally, the variances are different. There's no doubt about it. Well, hang on just a second. No, I don't mean a hard hang on, just hang on just a second. What a lot of people say when they see that slide is, gee, you should be doing non-parametric regression. You should be fitting a curve, right? That's one thing people say. That's the thing most people say. And then other people will say, gee, why don't you just build a distributional model for it and, you know, use the distributional model? Well, the reason for this is that if you look month after month, let's go, I'm sorry, here's 1980. In 1980, there were a couple thousand firms now. And, of course, if you go on in time, there's even more and more, and then you just get a blue blur unless you do some other display method. There's still a bit of this tendency that you observe here and one big outlier, but what I will tell you, and I have the transparency, I can show you. If you look month after month, the only thing that's persistent month after month is the dagger shape. That is roughly this right here. And sometimes you get a bulge like this and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you get an outlier, sometimes you get a few, sometimes you don't. So whenever someone says to me, look, mixture models work, fit a mixture model, I say, go do it. Go do it reliably, and no one has risen to the challenge yet because, you know, there's not enough data to support it in the first place, and it's not stationary anyway. So this is the perfect context for robustness in the sense that robustness is doing well near a parametric model. And when a little thing happens here or there, you want to still get a good description of the bulk of the data, okay? So I just want to show you now I actually repeated Pham and French's experiment with data that Peter Kanez gave me. So this is the time series of slopes of fitting the straight line by least squares from 1963 to the end of 1990. And I would love to give this talk at University of Chicago and say, why are you building a t-statistic on this anyway? This is nonsense. I mean, there's a whole period of time here where there was something structural going on, but there's this tendency in finance to take really long time periods because, well, you know, monthly data and so on, you got to get enough data, right? In any event, it's pretty clear that it's not surprising to see the t-statistic be significantly negative for this picture, right? So here's when you do it with a robust regression, everything kind of shifts up. Well, I said, gee, I wouldn't make this inference on all the data anyway. I might just say, gee, even just looking at it, the last part of the data looks fairly stationary, even without testing it. And so just to kind of show what happens, there's the 95% confidence intervals for the mean. In the Fama-French case, which would say, gee, there's no relationship between equity returns and firm size, and the bottom one shows quite clearly yeah, there really is a positive relationship between equity returns and firm size. So the true story here is that I think this what robustness gets you is an answer that's a much better description of the reality. The reality is not simply that equity returns are negatively related to firm size. The reality is, for the bulk of the firms, equity returns are slightly positively related to firm size, and there's a small fraction of small size firms from month to month that have unusually or abnormally large returns. Right? That's a better answer, I think. By the way, I mean, you know, it's not surprising that small size firms have outlying returns, right? I mean, it's sort of, you can imagine all sorts of things. They're kind of new in the market. Their CEO told a good story to Wall Street, or they rolled out a new marketing program. Oh, and by the way, they're trading at a buck, right? And returns, that's something that, by the way, is rather overlooked, which you sort of alluded to indirectly, which is returns can only go down 100% with this definition of returns, but they can go up arbitrarily high. So the distribution is definitely skewed in the upward direction. Now, this problem goes away to some extent, but not completely, if you use log ratio or differences on a log scale, which is what people do theoretically, you know, when they build Black-Scholes models. But it doesn't solve the problem. It just reduces the positive outliers and increases the negative outliers when they occur. So that's story one, okay? Let's move on to story two. This really is a recap of the Knez and Reedy result that I just put together. I use it in classes and so on. I keep showing it primarily because these methodologies have not emerged at all in finance, hardly. The Knez and Reedy is a singular paper in the Journal of Finance on this topic. And econometricians are getting into this act somewhat more rapidly than people in finance. And for some reason, I don't know, it's just very, what was Tukey's term, sanctified. OLS is sanctified, right? And now that we can do exact inference, ha-ha, you know, this is the way we go. So anyway, the next story has to do with estimating beta with robust estimates. And I'm going to tell you what beta is in a moment, but in terms of equations and so on. But beta is a commonly used measure of risk and return. If you're looking at, you know, a stock and it has a beta of 1, it says that its expected return is about that of the market. If it's bigger than 1, its expected return is larger than the market, and if it's less than 1, its expected return is less than the market. At the same time, if a beta is equal to 1, its risk in terms of standard deviation is about the same as the market. If it's bigger than 1, it has a larger risk. If it's smaller than 1, it has a lower risk than the market. Suppliers compute it and deliver it to all sorts of users. Estimations based on OLS, and you know what the story is going to be. There are going to be outliers. So beta is usually taken as the coefficient in the simple market model. Okay, so this is the market. Could be the S&P 500 or commonly a composite of the three major exchanges in a market capitalization weighted way. So simple straight line fit. By the way, portfolio returns, if you make a portfolio with weights WI in a bunch of different stocks, then the return of the portfolio is just the weighted sum of the returns of the individual stocks. So here are the basic relationships. For your portfolio, if you just do the algebra a little bit, you will find that the variance of the portfolio is the variance of the market multiplied just by the weighted sum of the betas. So if you wanted to make a portfolio that sort of had about the same beta as the market, you could put different betas in there. They should somehow sum up to 1 when weighted, though. If you want a riskier portfolio in the market, then this beta P should be bigger than 1, and so on. Now, what's left over here is the sum of the weight squared times the error terms in the model. And what is true, that you could check by just using weights 1 over N, for example, that if you diversify your portfolio by making N pretty large, then that term left over there is going to be small. Okay? It's not a sum of weights times sigma I squared, it's a sum of weights squared, and that's why diversification makes this term small. This is usually called the diversifiable risk in a portfolio, and this is the non-diversifiable or systematic risk in the portfolio. Now, the famous capital asset pricing model says that basically, formally what I said before, only in terms of excess returns. So this RZU is like a risk-free rate, like a 90-day T-bill rate. So if you look at the expected return of your stock above the T-bill rate and compare it with the expected return of the market above the T-bill rate, then beta is the multiplier. So this is where beta, the bigger ones, as you get better, larger expected excess return. But up there, it would lead to a larger risk, okay? So it's a measure of risk and return. So sort of spurred on by Knez and Reedy's results, I said, well, gee, nobody looks at outliers in estimating beta. Let's take a look. And we found there's almost no research in the literature on this. The first real research was by Sharp, who was the father of CAPM and got the Nobel Prize for the capital asset pricing model. Sharp wrote a paper in which he used the L1 estimate to fit these straight lines. He said, gee, you know, no problem. It looks like least squares. But that was in 1971, and he used pretty much two things. He used mutual funds, and then he used sort of a small universe of large companies. And he didn't see any outliers because there weren't any there, and so things agreed. That's not true today. So Tim Sim and I have been working on this, and I just want to show you some prototypical results here. Just four different stocks from 6,000 that we studied. Top left picture, a few big outliers. OLS says beta is 2.33. The robust says it's 1.1. The one in the upper right, OLS says 3.27. That had a humongous outlier. And most of these, by the way, we checked are just real returns. These are not data errors in this case. Same down in the bottom. What's going on here is sort of a general tendency we found that when the outliers occur and influence the least squares beta, it's not always true, but there's a tendency for them to be positive and large when the market's on the upside. And we don't have a very good reason for that. There's sort of some intuitive reasons, and it's not a hard and fast rule either, but it sort of provokes your thought to look a little further into, you know, how and why they happen. The other comment I would make here is that the standard errors for the robust estimate are considerably smaller than those for least squares for obvious reasons. For OLS, you use sum of squared residuals, you got a big outlier, blows up the standard error. So this is kind of typically how things happen. I took one transparency out of here. Oh, well. The transparency I took out had some, for one example, had parallel lines like this showing where that psi function sort of went to zero. In other words, parallel lines that show outside of those parallel lines, those data points had weight zero. And sorry, I forgot that one. I meant to show it. But so here's some kind of summary results. What we did was we had we did this for monthly data and weekly data in two different experiments. And in this one, it was monthly data. We had we basically took all the firms that existed for at least 10 years up to 1990. Sometimes it was 5 years, 7 years. So they were varying lengths in this particular experiment. And we just binned the difference between the OLS and robust beta. And if you looked at bins starting at 0.3, you can do statistical inference on this, but I can tell you that most consumers of this start to get uneasy if the difference between the OLS beta and the beta when you take one point out is greater than 0.3 or so. And they'll be stark raving mad at 0.5. So if you just took 0.3 as the starting point, you add all this up, you find that you get more than 10% of the firms had differences greater than 0.3. In the weekly data that I don't show here, just for simplicity, it's even worse. In the weekly data, almost 20% of the firms had differences between the OLS and robust beta greater than 0.5, and that is humongous. Okay, so the differences are substantial. This slide says it's a small firm effect. So what this slide shows is the box plots of the market capitalizations, or the size, if you like, So here's the bin for which there was very little difference between OLS and robust beta, and there's the center of the distribution of market cap. And you can see as you have larger differences, the market capitalization goes down. So it tells a very clear story. The outliers are a problem primarily for the small size firms, and that's not surprising. That kind of just confirms your intuition, because it's the small size firms that have more volatility, are likely to have some big upsides due to one reason or another. You saw that in this other picture here. So my recommendation to suppliers would be something like the following. Compute both, set some delta, maybe let the user set delta, the client, and if the difference is less than delta, give them OLS, and the difference is greater than delta, well, report the robust beta as well as OLS, and then give them some other information. Give a time series of the returns with the dates at which the outliers occurred, and there is a tendency for these outliers to, just a tendency for them to fall near quarterly time intervals. Well, quarterly time intervals are sort of when CEOs make, you know, earnings announcements and things like that. So there's another level of investigation that's suggested here. It's true. Last but not least, you know, sort of robustness is data mining again is, well, we actually started to put together a little robust beta miner, we called it. And the idea was to say, let the user define his or her universe of stocks that they're interested in, set a threshold, and then search the database and return those firms for which there was a big difference, and then return associated information. And then obviously the next thing you want to do is do the news search and find out whether Greenspan opened his mouth the day before and so on, yeah, stuff like that. But I guess kind of, you know, a real sort of concept of data mining that could be useful. You've got a lot of data. You don't know where the unusual stuff is. Isn't this sort of an interesting problem? I mean, it's a straight line fit. You do that in stat 101 or stat minus 1. But there's 6,000 of them or 10,000 of them, you know? So I guess I would say, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on data mining as for humongous data sets, you know, gigabytes at least and terabytes. What I like to try to emphasize that, while that is true, there are a lot of problems like that, what constitutes large enough to require, quote, data mining is just large enough that you or I can't do it in any reasonable amount of time. This is a problem that you and I can't do it in a reasonable amount of time unless we automate it and do some search. That's an honest data mining problem. So those were the two stories, and I hope they were convincing that there is potentially, I mean, they're simple problems, but that there's potentially a useful role for robust statistics in finance, and there's a bunch of other major problems in finance. Well, fitting factor models, I had hoped to have an example for you for that 60-parameter model, and it turned out that I spent 2 days just kind of getting the data organized. So I thought I could do it in a day, but, you know, in a week or two, I'll have some results. Yield curve smoothing, you know, robust covariance matrices are used for all sorts of things in finance. Covariance matrices are, I should say, in robust versions should be. Robust portfolio optimization, robust volatility modeling. There's a whole panoply of interesting and important problems in which people in industry, not just in academia, compute daily. And lots of money's involved in it. And there's lots of outliers. And so I think there's a lot to do here. And now, last but not least, hey, it's only about an hour. I'll say a few words about this robust library. It is funded by an NIH grant for 2.5 years, and we have the rest of this year, and then we'll run out of money. And there's been a great team of consultants, Victor Yohai, Ruben, Alfio Marazzi in Lausanne. A lot of people who work in robustness are consultants on it. And we, in this release in April, we will have linear regression, generalized linear models for the logistic and Poisson case, robust covariance, robust principal components, robust fitting of some asymmetric distributions like Weibull and gamma, robust discriminant analysis, and maybe a couple other things. And then we'll make another release near the end of the year. We are very much looking for users to beat on it and give us feedback. And I'm trying to stretch the funding out at a lower rate so that at the end of the year we can sort of take users' feedback. I will give you Well, you can just look at the Insightful website, insightful.com website, or contact me, and I can pass you on the right person if you're interested. I'm going to give you a little demo here, but let me just, to be sure, let me just... brand new name. And then if you can't find, you can download it on the website, actually, a version now. And right now you'd have to get the beta version of S+6 to run it. So they're also very much interested in having S+6 beta testers. This is S+6 on NT Windows. As I said earlier, maybe too quickly, we already have S+6 on Unix last year. But I'm focusing right now on the Windows version more because, largely because of point three in these bullet points up here. Really trying to emphasize a user interface paradigm that looks just like what you do anyway if you fit a linear model or a generalized linear model. I'll show you an example now. And emphasize the default as you compute both and you get to see stuff right away that will raise a red flag and tell you whether outliers are present or not. So let me just go to the two brief little demo things. The first one, robust regression, and the second one, I'm going to show you the visualization part. So this is S+2000, not the beta of S+6. This is not a financial example I'm going to show you. As I said, I'm working on the large factor model. It's not quite right. So here's a, if we go to linear model, we get a dialogue. How many of you have used S+ on Windows here? How many of you use S+ on Windows? Okay. Those are for, if you have or if you haven't, I can tell you this dialogue looks exactly like if you go to the statistics menu and go to regression and go linear, you'll get, let me put them side by side there. This dialogue looks exactly like that dialogue except for two things on the front page. Right here, there's the radio buttons with LS plus robust, the default. If you only want LS, you can do this. If you only want robust, you can do that, but we're going to ship it this way. I took a poll of users and about 75% said, yeah, they would like to have it that way. There's one other thing. There's an options tab here to set all the fancy tuning parameters for pros who want to fool around with it. It's actually going to appear as an advanced tab up here in the final release. So the idea is that although this is a library this year, the hope is that next year there won't be a library anymore. There'll be just these new radio buttons on LM and GLM and Cove and everything in sight that we can get done in that amount of time. Maybe before I show you the example, I should just comment on the fact that it's been sort of sad in one way that robust methods have not been available for users. Right? There's been a lot of research done over 20, 30 years, and so why is that? Well, is it because they're not useful? No. I think the reason, a large part of the reason, is because there are too many estimators. And how does, you know, a commercial provider knew how to do least squares. All they had to do is figure out how to do it numerically right and add some bells and whistles. But now there's least median squares, there's least trim squares, there's this, there's, you know, so what does SAS know? What does, you know, StatsEye know what to put in there? Well, you know, we just took the bull by the horns and said we're going to get some money and we're going to make it happen. And I think the fundamental notion here is that as far as the actual algorithm, we'll use the best we know today. But try to get the paradigm set. Try to get people just naturally using it. And okay, if 2 years from now, you know, we get the 300 horsepower engine, so the 200 horsepower engine, yeah, we'll plug it in, you know, and it'll be a little better. But meanwhile, we're giving people a useful tool. That's, you know, the deep satisfaction of combining developing software with, you know, being in a field like statistics is actually to build, for me, is actually to build products that people can really use and kind of advance the practice, if at all possible. So anyway, I'm going to pick a famous data set here. That's the stack loss data, which I think everyone who teaches a regression course, or at least people used to, you know, use this data set. It's in a number of books. So the response variable is loss. So you go up here in the dialogue, dependent variable, and say, okay, I'm going to make that loss. Look at the bottom down there. See where this formula is being created. Let me erase it again and start over. So I'll go up here and I'll choose loss. And down here it starts building the formula for the model. So loss appeared down here. And then I'll go in here and I'll say, well, airflow, shift, click this. And it built the rest of the model. It's just an additive model, no interaction terms. If you want interaction terms, you can type them in here. You can get them in several ways. But we're all ready to go, except let's see, what plots do we want? Okay. I guess I'll just make all these plots for now. So we'll just say click. Do click. And so you're going to see Trellis graphics for the first time today if you've never seen it before in the output, okay? So let me start back here and say, well, what we did, Trellis sort of is a way of arranging plots where you slice on other variables, either categorical or numeric. In this case, the way we've introduced a device when we fit robust models and classical models, we've introduced a new class in S Plus called fit.models. And what if you think command line or at the programming language level, what fit.models, there's a function called fit.models that lets you specify any number of models. And then it goes off and produces those model fits and puts them all in a list so that they're all collected in one place. Then we have methods that operate on this collection of fitted models. And one of the methods, the plot method, makes these trellis graphs. So it looks in there and it sees, well, there were two models. There was a least squares fit and a robust fit. And it lays these plots out like this. So the from the two side-by-side QQ plots, least squares and robust, you can already see that for the robust method, these outliers stick up at the top that didn't stick up there. This one, which stuck out a little bit, sticks out more. Now, if we go to the next page, I've got kernel density estimates of the residuals for least squares and for robust. So this is actually, I think, a better plot than the first one as a just a diagnostic. So you look at this plot and you say, okay, least squares, okay, you know, little kinks, but might be normally distributed errors, no signs of outliers. You look at this fit, and you see that the bulk of the error distribution is much more compact, and then you get these bumps over here that are generated by the outliers, right? So let's go to the next plot. The next plot is, you may, if you heard Rousseau's talk, I'm sure many of you have seen it. This is a plot of, in the x direction, robust distances. There were three predictor variables here. So a robust covariance matrix is estimated, and the robust Mahalanobis distances are plotted in the x direction, and the y direction are the standardized residuals. So for the least squares fit, what do you see? Well, you see, yeah, there were four large independent variables that could be possible leverage points, but there are no outliers in the residuals. And then you go over here, and wow, gee, suddenly there are four residuals that are very large, they're outliers. It happens that three of them were associated with three of the four leverage points, but one wasn't. And then finally, just the residuals standardized versus time for least squares. Again, this is what you get out of every OLS package if you did this. Gee, there's nothing interesting going on there. But in fact, what's going on is this. There were three outliers out of the first four data points. This is the process was started up as an industrial process. And then it was shut down. There was a transient. So I think this is the kind of thing that really should lead one to believe that robustness could have a role as a, quote, data mining tool. It sort of exposes the unusual data points that you would have overlooked. And anyway, since robustness has never made it, I think the last-ditch effort is to call it a data mining tool, right? I'm sure that's going to do it, right? It's all marketing. Okay, I'm going to show you one more example now, and then we'll call it quits. Oh, this is just a report showing side-by-side layout of robust and least squared t-values and so on. Okay. What I want to do now is this data, this is the data I had up earlier. Let me just make a scatter plot of it first and probably throw the scatter plot away. But it's that 1963 scatter plot of equity returns versus firm size. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to just focus on returns and throw away the size and just make a normal QQ plot for you, okay? Now, but remember this picture and keep this picture in mind. This picture says to you that small-size firms are much more variable than large-size firms. So therefore, the conditional distribution of returns given size changes and is obviously very non-Gaussian for small-size firms and maybe fairly Gaussian for large-size firms. So, okay, so let's get rid of this and go back. And in this panel, just choose returns. Go over to this little handy-dandy plot palette and go down here where it says QQ normal. Click it. And that's the normal QQ plot with a robust line fit for all of the returns, okay? Now, trellis graphics, which is one of the, I think, great inventions of Bill Cleveland at Bell Labs, allows you to slice this data on size. So the way that works is like the following. And have any of you seen this? Have you used it? Any of you have used S Plus? If you haven't, it's a great gadget. You can do it at the command line or you can do it here. So I'm going to take size as the slicing variable, click on it, and drag it up. And watch as you drag it up what happens. See how that little rectangle appears up here? You put it in here, you drop it in there, and in a few seconds, you get now four conditional QQ plots for four slices of the size variable. And the way this algorithm works, it makes four slices of essentially equal number of counts in each slice. That's why you see this little orange thing here. It gets a little narrower there and a little narrower there and then wider there. That's because, you know, it has to adjust to the variant density along the size direction. You can change that to equal. There's all sorts of tailoring this you can do. But look what this picture tells you, more or less. Right away it says, gee, for the smallest size firms in this range, very non-normal data. And hint, hint, maybe two linear pieces. Maybe two linear pieces. What does two linear pieces suggest? Maybe it's a normal mixture. Maybe fitting a normal mixture is a good exercise. It turns out it is. And then by the time you get up to this size firm, it's getting pretty straight, you know. So, you know, I love this tool both for revealing interesting structure in data but also for teaching statistics 101. You could put density estimates here. What nicer way to treat conditional ideas than in a highly interactive graphics environment like this? If you wanted to change, by the way, the number of panels, you could just right-click inside the plot, go down to where it says multi-panel, and here are all the parameters you can play with. So up here, there's continuous conditioning, number of panels, four. Let's make six slices instead of four. You can change other things, too, but let's just do that. See, it's pretty quick, actually, pretty speedy. So now it's taken six slices. And, you know, you can slice on more than one variable. So let me throw this away, and let's go back to returns again, and let's make our QQ plot again, okay, of all the returns. Let's go here and say, well, suppose you want to really slice and dice on both size and this is book to market, by the way, log of the book to market variable, book value of a stock to market value. So if I grab both of those and take them up, then it slices on both variables, and you get two strips, right? So you only get two size strips and two book to market strips. So this is pretty useful if you want to find out how, you know, slicing on both of the variables affect things. Okay. Well, I promised you that I would only do a tiny bit of visualization. That's the tiny bit of visualization. It's supposed to be a taster that. That's also a data mining tool. I mean, you can look into data pretty quickly and find structure that way. It's kind of a complement to dynamic graphics, really, where you can slice with dynamic graphics. It has different strengths and weaknesses than things like XCOBE. Well, that's it, I think. I'm out of energy. Time for questions. Any?
I think that I'm going to select the who to answer.
Oh, somebody asked me, what's an outlier?
Oh, yeah. Question.
No, yeah. Yes, okay, I understand.
Oh, you don't want me to answer that one? I had time to think about that one.
Another question. In this finance data, how often is the data really homostatic, you know, or heterostatic? Is there a problem that you have to worry about?
There is quite often in financial data inhomogeneity of variance. Okay. And let me say that one of the hottest areas in general where that appears is in volatility modeling. So, you know, you look at the returns over time. I don't have a handy set here. If you look at returns over time from anything, from the S&P 500, you will see that volatility, you know, look like this, and then it'll come down, and then it'll go up. And there's a whole class of models called Garch models are the most popular for modeling that. Time-varying volatility, that's a time-varying, you know, variance. And it's true that if you just marginalize and you look in a univariate way, a lot of the heavy tailedness comes because you're mixing normal things together through volatility changes. Now, it turns out that once you take that out, there still tends to be leftover outliers once you adjust for that. Like if you fit Garch models and you look at the residuals from your Garch model fit, it just doesn't take out all the outliers. And it's not enough to fit a Garch model based on a t-likelihood either. I can promise you that.
Yeah. But the question I'm concerned with, your regression estimates, they're not necessarily robust. You make them robust to kind of like the extreme observations.
Right,
not
right.
Necessarily to the assumption of a heterostatic.
Yeah.
I don't know what the least median square is, how badly it does with the heterostaticity.
How badly it does, or how good?
Yeah, yes.
It does bad anyway, even without that.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But yeah, I actually, for this kind of data that we were looking at, you know, the sort of dagger thing, one could go in and estimate sort of the conditional error variance for that fairly nicely for these large data sets. I didn't do that. I don't think at this stage of the game it's terribly important, but one could easily do that. I mean, there's enough data in the bulk of the data to get a fairly nice profile of residual scale, non-parametrically. I don't think it'll make much difference in this case here.
Okay. Okay, another quick comment.
Yeah.
Though I think this the robust, they forms a nice way to do the summary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then if you're going to do inference and maybe some risk analysis, mm-hmm. I think you have to mm-hmm. be careful about whether those are stream observations, mm-hmm. if we were not, and consider those in terms of the risk analysis.
Yeah.
So that's just
another
comment.
Yeah. That comment comes up all the time, and it's a perfectly good comment. If you are doing risk calculations, you definitely want the tail of the distribution, right? And no doubt about it. In fact, I have a nice example that when I was first playing with this. So if you look at returns distribution, they tend to be more peaked, and then they have outliers, right? So if you fit a normal distribution, it's very clear that it sort of fits very badly. It's too broad because the outliers, you know, stretch it due to inflated standard deviation. But if you use the median and say the median absolute deviation, the opposite happens. You get a good fit to the bulk of the data, but the tail model's off. So that's just not a place for robustness at all. But when you fit structural models, when you're fitting the structural model itself, that's where I think robustness works and is important. And the other thing I would say that I think I might have said earlier, but outliers are almost never predictable, right? So, you know, so if you're estimating beta, for example, and you say, gee, well, there were a couple outliers, and maybe it's fairer to let the outliers influence the beta. But what can you say about the future with regard to your risk and reward? Well, you know, nobody's putting down bets on the one or two outliers, but the core part of the data is the part that you can sort of reasonably hope to build predictive models for. Not to say that, you know, there aren't some kind of event study opportunities, you know, to sort of look at, because I think there is a tendency for outliers to occur associated with, you know, CEO announcements and things like that. Yeah.
I mean, a theoretical question about in your definition of
right.
robustness.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in probability about statistics, but it seems to me maybe, I mean, one might argue that your definition of robustness is in a way too stringent. I mean, you're requiring that if somebody adds an atom, you know, of a small atom of probability
right,
at 10
right.
to 100,
right.
that shouldn't affect
right,
our,
right.
Estimates.
Right. As opposed to
yeah.
100
yes.
or 10 or
yes.
in that sense.
So
yeah.
maybe you're requiring too much of your robust estimate.
Yeah, I think this question, if you if you're playing the min-max game, which we are when we can do it, which isn't that often, but the theoretical side of, you know, my brain likes having it. And then the question is it like the way min-max can fail, right? You know, the classic picture like this, and, you know, and I don't think that really happens here. I mean, the structure of the solution is so compelling in this case, right? Mm-hmm. It's like when Huber, you know, did his first min-max variance result, he got, you know, he got that loss function and this kind of psi function and weights that went down like this. That was pretty nice because there was a beautiful theory and it was perfectly reasonable what was going on. The only limitation of that early version was he restricted to symmetric error or symmetric contamination distributions, and he wasn't looking at bias, right? I don't think so far it's too stringent when the estimator you actually get satisfies your intuitive feeling for how the estimator should behave or what it should look like. To me, that's when you fell with your nose in the butter and, you know, got a good theorem, which isn't always the case by a long shot. I think I could answer a question that was asked earlier, too. He asked me, what is an outlier? And I like the following definition. It's an outlier is a data point that will be rejected by a robust method of high efficiency at the Gaussian model. I guess that shut him up.
My definition. Okay.
Any other questions, comments, or Jim?
As a producer of software and manufacturer, at some point, did you ever worry about the possibility of litigation because your software, your methods actually produce misleading results? Possibly because
no, we have very good attorneys, and if you see the disclaimers, no problem at all. Sure, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Look, you can get sued for anything in America, so, you know. No matter what disclaimer you put, you could get...
You could make the argument that if it weren't robust, it could be misleading, right?
So, yeah.
So then, I suppose a user who's naive could rightly argue that this was a deficiency of serious sort, and he'd been misled by the non-robust procedure.
Crazy. Boy, I wonder if we could get SAS that way. That sounds like really... You know, the big guys, you've got to play dirty, right? That's great. You are going to edit this videotape appropriately, aren't you? Well, thanks for being so attentive for such a long time. It was fun to tell you about this stuff. Thanks.
Thank you very much, yeah.